Payne v. Hy-Vee. Mr. Sanders.
May it please the Court, my name is George Sanders and I represent the plaintiff appellant Denise McCann. One of the primary issues in this case concerns how this Court interprets a sale of the securities that are at issue in this case in 2008. The District Court determined that the 2008 transaction was not in connection with the fraudulent statements that occurred in this that Ms. McCann alleged it took place in 2002. Ms. McCann, however, alleged a unitary fraudulent scheme that involved a purchase in 2002, which the district court held it was a question of fact whether the purchase in 2002 was in fact a purchase for purposes of the private right of action. The court held, however, that the in connection with requirement was not satisfied for the 2008 transaction. Now, the problem with the district court's analysis is it confuses the scope of Section 10B with the scope of the private right of action. The in connection with requirement identifies and defines Section 10B scope, and the Supreme Court and the various appellate courts that have addressed this issue have all held that as long as there's some fraudulent conduct that touches the transaction, the in connection with requirement is met and Section 10B is triggered. Now, the private right of action is more narrow than the scope of Section 10B, and there is numerous cases that have defined the scope of the private right of action to meet various important policy concerns. For example, holder cases are not permitted because of the moral hazard that gets created by allowing plaintiffs to hold on their securities and wait to see what ultimately happens in the market. None of the policy reasons that limit the scope of the private right of action apply in this case, and that's where the district court went wrong. Ms. McCann was not a holder of the security. This was a case where Ms. McCann purchased the securities, the fraud was executed in 2008, and her stock was taken away from her involuntarily.
What was the upshot of the Iowa litigation?
There were several pieces of litigation, Judge, and two of those cases primarily dealt with family law matters that had no relation to the securities case. One dealt with the reinstatement of her maintenance, and another case involved her trying to stop the forced sale of the securities. Hy-Vee was not a party to either of those two cases. There was a third case that was dismissed, and Hy-Vee has never made a claim of collateral estoppel or res judicata here. And I don't believe that either of those doctrines would apply, even if they had. But it's hard for me to address complicated claims like res judicata or collateral estoppel that were never raised.
So there was a suit against Hy-Vee in Iowa?
There was one at some point, Judge, concerning the employment contract, the interpretation of the employment contract, but that was dismissed by Ms. McCann.
Okay.
There was never
so
an adjudication.
There was no decision. Okay.
No, there was never a decision on this. Ms. McCann's case truly is atypical, and one of the reasons the case they took is it does not affect the misrepresentations were not directed at the value of Hy-Vee stock. They were addressed at the marketability of the stock and the conditions under which the securities could be sold. This is not a case where if the court were to find that Ms. McCann's case falls within the private right, you're going to open the floodgates to all sorts of securities litigation that is going to inundate the courts and create moral hazard problems. This case, I think, is controlled by Norris v. Wirtz. In that case, the court held that the plaintiff had a private right of action, even though the plaintiff admittedly never had the securities, never purchased the securities or sold the securities. But because the case fundamentally involved the fraudulent actions that induced the plaintiff to give up her shares, the court held that the private right of action should apply. Now,
this is a statutory limitations case?
Correct, Judge. And the reason the characterization of the 2008 transaction is important is because if the 2008 transaction is a purchase or sale for purposes of 10B, it is our position that the period of limitations should start at that point, given this court's prior decisions in Short, McCool, and Ferguson. Now, but if we go to the statute of limitations issue, the district court argued, took the position that the period of repose would start at the time of what he considered the violation, which it determined.
Why do you think it starts?
It would start at 2008, Judge.
I'm not asking about this case. When do you think statutes of repose start to run?
They start upon the accrual of the action, which is, in a securities case, upon the sale.
That's not how statutes of repose work. I mean, if you have the sale of a product that turns out to be defective many years later, but it was defective when it was sold, and then someone is injured, the injured person's claim doesn't arise until he's injured, right?
Well,
so the statute of repose doesn't start to run then.
Statutes of repose are fundamentally creatures of statute, Judge. And Hyvie's argument really conflates this concept of general definitions for a period of repose as being linked to some specific act, as opposed to looking to the actual statute. In one of the cases, Beard, that they cited, which was a product
violation, right?
Well, Judge, the violation is not, and 10B is not simply making a misrepresentation. It's a misrepresentation, and well, I would also point to the
in my products liability case, when the manufacturer makes a defective product. It's either unreasonably dangerous or, you know, didn't use due care in creating it, whatever. That's a violation of his duty of care. It's not the tort. The tort doesn't occur until there's an injury, but it's a violation of the duty of care. Well, similarly, in a stock transaction, if the seller makes a misrepresentation, that's a violation of his duty. The harm may not occur for many years, right?
But that's a question of statute. In the Beard case, the Tennessee statute expressly
says. I'm analogizing to products liability. The violation of the duty of care is different from the accrual of the tort because it precedes the injury.
But the word violation.
Similarly, you're not supposed to make misrepresentations. You have a duty not to make misrepresentations in, you know, selling stock. So if you make a misrepresentation, you violated your duty. But the harm may not occur until many, many years later.
Well, but the
otherwise, I think you've just merged the statute of repose into the regular statute of limitations.
But that's
what would be the difference here?
Well, but that's
what would be the difference in the accrual date under the two statutes?
Well,
and the 6 years in this case.
Well, I think if you look at the
would there be a difference?
I don't believe there is. I think the
that's your problem. No. You're merging the statute of repose with the statute of limitations.
The Supreme Court in the Merck v. Reynolds case.
You tell me how you avoid this merger.
The Section 1658B has the fundamental trigger for both the statute of limitations, the discovery period, and the period of repose on the violation.
Well, it can't have the same. It can have the same trigger because then you never get to the statute of repose.
The discovery rule, as the Supreme Court in Merck stated, was a doctrine that delays accrual of the cause of action until the plaintiff has discovered it. The delaying of the accrual is the violation. And the violation cannot be simply the misrepresentation.
Well, what's a securities case in which a statute of repose bars the suit when the statute of limitations wouldn't?
Well, I mean, this court in Short, McCool, and Ferguson repeatedly stated
give me an example of a case where the suit would be barred by the statute of repose but not by the statute of limitations? Because if there isn't any such case, the statute of repose is a dead letter. It doesn't bar anything.
Well, I mean, if you have discovery, if the security transaction in this case happened in 2008, let's say it happens in 2008, and you learn about the securities fraud on the same date, the next day, the period of limitation will expire before the period of repose. If you were to learn about the fraud let's say, a year before the expiration of the period of repose, the period of repose would end the claim before the expiration of the two-year statute of limitations.
It's true here that it took her a long time to learn that there had been a misrepresentation by this chief financial officer.
Well, but that begs the question as to whether the period of repose starts from when you have a complete and present cause of action.
You just gave me a moment ago where the misrepresentation occurs, and instead of learning about it the next day, the victim of the misrepresentation learns about it, you know, 5 years later or something, and then it faces the statute of repose, right?
Well, but you want to have a fixed period for these, for a period of repose and for the discovery rule to begin. And when you have a situation, for example, you have multiple statements, let's say, in the market that are being made, which of those...
I still don't understand the difference. You gave me a case where, on the one hand, the victim of the misrepresentation learns a day after the misrepresentation and has the 3 years. And in the next case, well, it doesn't learn until 5 years. And now has only a year left before the statute of repose. Why is this case any different?
Well, because the question is when the period of repose and the limitations period...
Why is this case different from the hypothetical which you gave me 1 minute ago?
Well, because I believe the violation occurred. And we're trying to define what Congress meant when it...
But then in your case, she'd have 3 years, not 1 year. Because your theory, in your example, the violation would occur in the fifth year. That's the discovery. Well, then you'd have 3 more years.
No, Judge, the violation occurred in 2008 when she was injured, and she had a complete and present cause of action.
Understand. Look, you gave me a hypothetical in which if the person discovers the day after the misrepresentation, she has the 3 years. But if she discovers it 5 years later, she has only 1 year because she's facing the statute of repose. How is that different from this case?
Well, I would say Ms. McCann's federal securities claim started in the hypothetical, the securities claim started upon the purchase, the initial purchase. In our case, the federal securities claim started in 2008.
Why?
Because that was when she suffered her injury, and that is when she had a complete and present cause of action. And the Supreme Court in the Bay Area case was very clear, and it was dealing with a period of repose in that situation, and in a statute very similar to Section 1658B. And the Supreme Court stated that the general principle is that
products liability statutes of repose are triggered when the defective product is sold, not when the injury occurs.
But that's because the statute, in Beard, for example, the statute expressly stated that the period of repose would start at the time the product was sold. So in Bay Area, the Supreme Court was very clear to say that a legislature can have the period of repose begin before the plaintiff had a cause of action. But it said that that had to be expressly stated and defined in the statute, which, for example, in the Beard case and in products liability cases, the legislature has expressly done that.
Okay, that's helpful. I understand your argument now.
If I could just clarify for a minute, you're reading the statute 1658B as not containing a statute of repose at all.
No.
You're reading it as containing a statute of limitations and a discovery rule. That's how I understand your argument.
Well, I believe that when the Section 1658B is defined in the statute as a limitations period, I believe that at the fundamental point, this is a semantic point. A period of repose.
It's not a semantic point. Limitations periods and repose periods operate differently. And I understand your argument to be that the 5-year statute in B2 is a statute of limitations that is triggered upon accrual of the claim, which is to say when the injury occurs.
Well, no,
and that the sub 1 section is a discovery rule.
No, the position is that whether it's you call it a period of repose or a period of limitation, it is still the triggering event to see accrual of the cause of action.
Then you've conflated the two concepts of repose and limitations, as Judge Posner has been trying to illustrate, because the two kinds of statutes operate very differently. Accrual is not a concept that applies in statutes of repose.
Well, I mean, Section 1658B does not define the five-year period as a period of repose. The section is entitled a limitations period, and it has a discovery rule.
Those titles don't mean anything.
Well, but the purpose is Congress, the Supreme Court was very clear that Congress has to say if it is going to have an accrual date before the cause of action accrues, it has to state that. And it didn't state that. And counsel for Hy-Vee cited the Exxon case, but Exxon.
So you have bought a share of stock in General Motors in 1930, and in 2011 you discover you sell your stock, you sell it at a loss, or, you know, General Motors went broke 2 years ago, and you say, you know, I go back what they represented in 1930, and it was wrong, it was false. They said they'd never bargain with unions or something. It was false. And now they've gone broke because they bargained with unions, and I've been injured.
Well,
I have got 3 years.
Well, that's
the logic of your argument.
No, I believe that's a very different.
That's when the injury occurred. Misrepresentation in 1930, injury in 2009. 3 years to sue.
Well, in a typical securities case, when you've made a misrepresentation.
A typical case. You address my case.
In that case, Judge, one, you're dealing with forward statements by a corporation that would not, in my opinion, even trigger a federal securities claim. So you have a substantive problem.
The promoter says, look, we're never going to bargain with the union because they're poison. They're going to negotiate. They're going to insist on pensions and health care, and it's going to bankrupt us. We'll never do that. That's maybe Ford will do it. We'll never do it. That's a mystery. Okay, and suppose they're just saying that. They're lying. They know they're lying. But it just takes a long time for any injury to occur.
That would be, I don't believe, Judge, that case, that you could make the argument that the period of repose starts when you
understand.
Because in that situation, whatever harm you had would have occurred at the time you purchased. This is a case.
There's no harm. You bought the General Motors stock. Everything was hunky dory until they made improvident agreements with their unions and were led into bankruptcy, and your investment was wiped out.
Well, Judge, you would have to show, first of all, substantively, I don't believe that would be a viable case, simply because you would have to show that GM deliberately lied about its intentions.
Go back to their records, Mr. Sloan saying, yeah, we're going to fool these idiots who buy our stock. Okay, well, we'll give you a chance to rebut, but you've taken up more of your time. Ms. Hannon?
Hello, Your Honors. Tracy Hannon on behalf of the defendant and appellee, Hy-Vee, Inc. And I think Your Honors have hit on the fundamental flaw in this case and the reason why the district court properly found that this claim was barred by the five-year statute of repose.
Oh, it's 5 years?
Yes.
I said six.
Previously, there was a 1 and 3, and that changed to 2 and 5. So under Section 1658B, you have to bring it between the earlier of 2 years after discovery of the violation. That sets forth the statute of limitations, which is concerned with when this cause of action accrues. The other limitation is 5 years after the violation. That sets forth the statute of repose, and that is concerned with the defendant's alleged misconduct.
Is the statute susceptible of an interpretation that would hold sub 2, the 5 years, to be a statute of limitations, not a statute of repose, and sub 1, the 2 years, to be a discovery rule?
Your Honor, I do not believe so, and there is a discussion, I believe it is in the ExxonMobil case, where there are other statutes in which they specifically start the running from the accrual. And I think there could be an argument that it's a statute of limitations in both regards. One just adds an added element of a discovery rule. Here it clearly uses the term violation. And the violation in a 10B action is the misrepresentation or material omission by the defendant.
Well, a discovery rule doesn't dictate when the cause of action accrues. It simply forgives a delay post-accrual based on the victim's lack of knowledge.
True.
There are statutory schemes. They're common in states, limitations codes, that don't have statutes of repose. There's only statutes of limitations and discovery rules.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So that's not what this is? I mean, sub 1 is phrased in terms of discovery, not accrual.
That is, Your Honor, and that is focused on discovering of the facts sufficient to state a cause of action here, a cause of action for a 10b-5
facts
violation.
Constituting the violation.
Yes, and in that case, upon her discovery or knowledge of the alleged misrepresentation and her reliance upon that misrepresentation, she had to bring her claim. Alternatively, the outer limitations is 5 years from the actual violation, which is the misrepresentation. Some courts hold it's a misrepresentation tied together with the reliance, but in this case it's clear both of those happened in 2002, well before this case was filed in September of 2009. And I think the lower court correctly found that the statute of repose started to run, the 5 years started to run in 2002. That is when Hy-Vee allegedly misrepresented when the Ms. McCann's husband could sell his stock. That happened prior to or in August of 2002 when she entered into the divorce decree. Now, the argument that was also made in the briefing by the appellant that, well, you need to look at what happened in 2008. And I think the problem there with the district court correctly found is by 2008, if you even can consider that a sale, which we do not believe it is, it's when the appellant was forced to turn over the shares back to Hy-Vee. By that point, she knew that the statements made in 2002 regarding when these shares could be sold was false. And as the district court recognized, as this court has recognized in Stark Trading and in other decisions, you cannot form a securities claim when you've claimed to have purchased or sold after knowing of a falsity. You cannot have reliance in that context.
Well, she hardly had a choice. As I understand, this is an unusual case.
This is an unusual case, sure. Yes.
She was compelled by court order to turn over the securities.
Exactly.
And so her reliance interests were kind of irrelevant at that point.
Well, that's another good point, Your Honor. Yes. She says she was powerless to stop the sale, so there certainly was no investment decision.
She wanted
made.
To keep the stock and keep getting the alimony.
Yes. And that's what this case is really about. Did she? She would not have tied her alimony to when the stock could be sold. It is not a 10B securities action.
Right, her claims against her ex-husband.
Yes, which she tried.
But she lost that one.
She lost that one. Mm-hmm. She has had many bites at the apple here. She has now turned to Hy-Vee, and she has done so improperly, and she has certainly done so too late. And the last point I would like to make, even though the district court did not need to reach this point because it found that the five-year limitations was a bar, and also found there was a reliance issue if you were to look at 2008. But we believe under the allegations of the complaint, she would also be barred under the two-year limitations period. There are allegations in the complaint that by June of 2007, she knew that the statements made in 2002 about the stock were false. That is when the Hy-Vee, the defendant, appellee, agreed to repurchase the stock. That is when her ex-husband stopped making the alimony payments. That is at the core of her injury here. There was also court proceedings prior to 2 years prior to the suit being filed where it was clear that she had knowledge that she had been lied to. She did nothing until more than 2 years later. So for these reasons, the district court should be affirmed that this action is time barred. If there's any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hannon. Mr. Sanders, we'll give you another minute if you'd like.
Just two quick points. First of all, with respect to the hypothetical that you had given me concerning GM, the reason that case is different from this case is because in the GM's hypothetical, the injury would have happened upon the purchase because the hypothetical posits a situation where the value of the securities are inflated at the time of purchase. If you say we're not going to negotiate with unions, it means that you're keeping your costs down. So arguably what you're saying is our revenues are going to be higher than they really are going to be. That's your typical securities case. Mm-hmm. You inflate the value of the stock, and obviously at that point, the time of purchase, you've been harmed. Ms. McCann was not harmed when she took the Hy-Vee stock. The harm had none of the misrepresentations concerned the underlying value of the Hy-Vee securities.
Is that correct? Because the securities were actually worth less to her because of the fact that they might be redeemed, right?
Well, no. If the securities were in fact marketable, which is what Ms. McCann learned, the securities would have had a higher value, actually, when she purchased them. So she would have received a windfall.
Less to her because of the way it was tied to the alimony, right? So if she thinks that they would never redeem the stock, then her alimony is secure. But if they can redeem it, then the alimony goes away when it's redeemed, right?
Well, I don't think that you could look, because the dynamic would have been a very different deal if it had.
No, it would have been a very different deal, but there was a the false or the alleged false representation removed a risk, right? And you could say the same thing about the General Motors case. By promising never deal with unions, they remove a risk to someone who might buy the stocks but very suspicious of unions, right?
Well, but
so similarly, if she's very risk averse, and they told her it can be redeemed at any time, she might think, well, I don't want that deal.
But having a marketable security is also a benefit to Ms. McCann, because if she has financial
benefit, and there's a risk, and she might have evaluated it as undesirable to take this risk.
Those two could balance out, whereas in the GM situation, it's clear that the misrepresentation as to what you're going to do with your costs by not negotiating with unions leads to the direct potential, the only potential, of increasing the value of your securities. And that's a very different situation where you have what you have here, where you don't have one clear direction on the value of the securities, given the nature of Hy-Vee's misrepresentations. This was not a dispute between Ms. McCann and her husband.
You know what you're doing, though? In order to avoid the statute of repose, you've just given away the case on the merits, right?
No,
this misrepresentation was harmless because, actually, if they had admitted these remarkable securities, she would have been thrilled.
Well, that's why she didn't have a cause of action when the securities were purchased. She did have, which she was harmed in 2008.
No, that's not right. That's not right. No, if she had...
She wanted a lump sum settlement on divorce. That's what she wanted. But the stocks were illiquid because they couldn't be transferred.
Well,
the family assets were tied up in the stock that was employment-based, based on the ex-husband's employment.
Well, her allegation was she had asked for it, but that's not necessarily where this would have ended.
Right,
it could have ended in a lot of different ways, but she was
suggesting that if he had told the truth, she would have said, great.
She might have taken the stock in any event. I mean, there still was a decision that had to be...
But if she'd done that, she'd be in the same fix she is now.
Well, no, because the deal that would have been negotiated would have been very different. Ms. McCann, based on how...
Why would it have been... You're saying that if they had said, this is marketable stock, she would have said, great, it's worth more, so fine, right? So how was she injured?
She was injured because she was told that the securities had certain characteristics that could not be changed.
And you just said a minute ago that if they said it didn't have these characteristics, that it was marketable, that it could be redeemed at any time, that that would have made the securities worth more. And that would have made it more attractive to her, and she would have accepted them, right?
That's right.
Yeah, but that means there's been no injury. There's no injury.
Well, Judge, but that's not what she was told, and she based her life after the divorce on a misrepresentation. She structured a divorce settlement based on what Hy-Vee had told her concerning the marketability of these securities. And because the fraud went to the marketability of securities, she wasn't injured when she took, because she received Hy-Vee stock. That's what she received. Well, she was injured in 2008, because in 2008 is when she learned that these stocks were marketable and Andy could sell the stock at any time, apparently.
She learned that in 2007.
No, Judge. Our complaint was very clear. She received a check from Mr. McCann from his personal account in 2007. There was months of litigation, and Ms. McCann learned at some later point
in 2007 at the hearings in state court and the state litigation.
Well, but when in 2000, the complaint was filed in September of 2009, Judge, so we would fall within the two-year period, depending on a very complicated factual question as to when she would have learned that Mr. McCann actually always had the ability to buy. Because she didn't know, Judge, there's no allegation that she even knew that Hy-Vee.
Suppose they had truthfully told her these are marketable securities, and she had said, okay, that makes them worth more. There's a risk, but, you know, it's fine. Back in 2002, I'll take that risk. Then wouldn't she be in the same position today?
If she had been told that the securities were marketable in 2002?
All the securities are marketable, she says, I'm just echoing you, that means they're worth more than if they... that's generally true. They're worth more. And fine, okay, I'll take the deal. She'd be in an identical position today.
No, because if they were marketable, she wouldn't have given her husband an opportunity to terminate 5 years of her maintenance, which was hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So
based
you're
on
but what if, well, that's very speculative, because suppose they say to her, you know, these stocks are marketable, redeemable, and so on. And he said, so that's a risk for you, but on the other hand, they're worth more because they're marketable. Suppose she said, all right, I'll take the risk. I'll live dangerously, right? Then she'd be in the same pickle she is now, right?
That assumes that if the securities were marketable.
Is that right? She'd be in the same position now.
No, Judge, because she would have been able during that 5 years, if she wanted to capture the excess value of the stock. What happened to her is in 2008, she was forced to sell the stock at a time she didn't want to sell it and was hit with a very substantial tax burden because Mr. McCann was able to shift to her the lowest basis for the stock, which if there had been a unitary sale based on the terms of the employment contract, that tax obligation would have been evenly spread. So she lost on the taxes, she lost on the maintenance, and she lost the securities, Judge. And if she had known that the securities were marketable, she could have sold them 2 years later if she believed that she could have obtained more value from selling the stock than any continued maintenance that she would have received. But that's not the deal she struck.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Mr. Sanders and Ms. Hannon. Next.